Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery. Not just anybody.
Hello and welcome to Real Recovery. We've got Bill Arnold on this side of the studio and then at his lake studio, George P. Fraser, a man who once wanted to open up a bait shop but gave up after he had trouble catching the little minnows. George, welcome.
Hey, thanks, Bill. Good to be here.
Those little minnows are hard to catch, aren't they?
I've never caught a fish. I've lived on the lake 30 plus years.
Why don't you ever go fishing? You've got a pontoon boat. You should get out there with a fishing rod and try to catch dinner.
I don't drink anymore, Bill. That's one reason.
Okay, well, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. So tonight, George, we're going to hear an amazing story from Rosie. She grew up with an alcoholic parent, and I was just chatting with her before the start of the show about some of the traits of an adult child of an alcoholic. And I ran a couple by her, and she went, yep, yep, yep. And one of the things that is on the list is you have a sense of kind of a responsibility. It's this overdeveloped sense of responsibility. And it's oftentimes easier to be concerned with others than with yourself.
Okay.
Well, that's just one of many of the traits of an adult child of an alcoholic.
So read that one again, could you please?
We have an overdeveloped sense of responsibility, and it is easier for us to be concerned with others rather than ourselves. This enables us not to look too closely at our own faults.
You know, that's interesting. I had an alcoholic parent, and I don't think I'm responsible at all. So it can't be universal. Mm-hmm. But it's amazing how many of those traits, as you look at it, do apply to you. And I think maybe for a lot of us, it's the first time we realize we do that when we see it in black and white and go, yeah, I do that.
Mm-hmm. And another one is we are frightened by angry people and any personal criticism. So I know you're afraid of me. So that probably does apply to you.
You know, I was thinking of one person. Well, no, you know, emotionally volatile, out of control people scare me. So... mm-hmm. Yeah.
We judge ourselves harshly and have a low self-esteem. That can be one of the symptoms of an adult children of alcoholics, according to the organization.
Can you judge yourself harshly but not have a low self-esteem?
Probably, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And
keep going.
Oftentimes we are people who have stuffed our feelings from our traumatic childhoods, and we've lost the ability to feel or express our feelings because it hurts too much.
I would think, too, in that environment, you would stop doing it because they get invalidated every time you do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. You know, you don't feel that way, do you?
No. No. How about this one?
No, that was, I was role playing there, Bill.
No, I wasn't going to play back with you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But I would think a lot of times when you're concerned about your parents drinking and you share something about how it affects you, it's going to get minimized, refuted, denied.
Of course.
And then spun on you that it's not a valid concern of yours and your feelings aren't important.
Mm-hmm. Another one of the characteristics is you become isolated and afraid of people and authority figures. I know there's friends I had growing up who didn't like having friends come over to their house because they were too afraid that their parent was going to be inebriated and they didn't want their friends to see it. So it was easier just to not have friends over and therefore more isolation.
I could see that. I would think the hard part would be you have nothing to compare it to, so this is normal for you.
Mm-hmm. Here's another one that's kind of tricky. We either become alcoholics, marry them, or both, or find another compulsive personality such as a workaholic to fulfill our sick abandonment needs. I don't know what to make of that one.
Yeah, well, you're going to fill it with something. And we've talked many times on the program, if you don't get what you need growing up from your parents, affirmation, security, you're going to find it in other places.
George, here's one that might apply to you. We became addicted to excitement.
Yeah, so what's your point?
Well, I'm saying I think that might be you.
You think it might be me?
Yeah, I think it might be you.
I think it is me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, let's look at a few more, and then let's do a step, and then let's bring on our guest. How's that?
It sounds great.
Yeah, we live life from the viewpoint of victims, and we are attracted by that weakness in our love and friendship relationships. So we get a little bit of a victim mentality, and you are attracted by that weakness in our love and friendship relationships. I didn't mean to make you think so hard tonight, George.
Now, you know, I don't understand that. I get the theory on it, but I'm pretty complicated.
Mm-hmm. How about this one? We are dependent personalities who are terrified of abandonment and will do anything to hold on to a relationship in order not to experience painful abandonment feelings, which we received from living with sick people who were never there emotionally for us.
I could see where that would be very true for people, but I would think it could also be true for a kid whose parent dies or, you know, some other divorce, something like that. I'm sure you would carry that into your adulthood.
Mm-hmm. So that's just a couple of traits of an adult child of an alcoholic that is from the Adult Children of Alcoholics organization. You can learn more about that at adultchildren.org. George, let's talk about a step tonight, which we always do in Real Recovery, now in its 10th year.
I wanted to talk about two steps tonight, Bill. I want to talk about 1 and 10, and I think they always apply here. The steps always apply. Step 1, we admitted we were powerless over drugs and alcohol and that our lives were unmanageable. And 10, we continued to take our personal inventory. And when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. So when we take our inventory, Bill, every day, and this step is different than 4, where we look at our moral inventory, we're looking at all the good things God has done for us. And if you're in step 10 and you've been working through the steps, you're probably sober from your behavior or your use, and you're working along becoming more Christ-like. And we can take the inventory and go, gosh, I'm sober, and give credit to God. But also, what do I need to work on? And I think for the majority of us who get into recovery, and whether it's a chemical, a behavior, moving away from our sinful lifestyle. We always say on the show that if you're a Christian, you're in recovery. Your life should be different than it was before. And we get to this point, and we've stopped the behavior, but we're still us that don't have that compensation piece. Okay, Bill? So I think for the vast majority of us in recovery, for me, I thought, well, if I can stop drinking and drugging, I'll be fine. There's a reason I used. I wasn't fine. And that brings us, when we take our inventory, to go back to step 1 and go, I'm powerless over my anger, my lust, my attitude, my sinful nature. And I bring God in, and I need to work on these things. And if we're moving towards Christ in a sanctification process, we need to keep moving forward. Paul said, press on towards the goal in Philippians. What he's talking about is the goal to be Christ-like, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is if you change your life It's very hard. It's very difficult. If it wasn't, you would have done it a long time ago. But it is worth it. And one of the things we get to is that principle of delayed gratification. Short-term work, long-term peace, productivity, feeling good about ourselves because we're doing what God wants us to do. And that's why we look at these steps as circular, not linear, where I cross one off. When I take my inventory and go, gosh, I got mad today and said something I wish I hadn't said that never applies to me except every day of my life, I go back to step one and, God, please forgive me for this. Give me the desire and the strength to work on my attitude and my tongue. I had a friend named Dick Barrett, and Dick passed away. And Dick didn't talk much. You might have known Dick, Bill. And I asked him one time, why don't you talk much? He said, the Bible says we're responsible for everything we say. And the best way for me to do that is to not say much. And I thought, gosh, I've taken the other track myself.
Yeah.
But we're looking at moving forward. And where this ties in, and a lot of times is, tonight I know we're going to talk about growing up in an alcoholic household. And maybe a lot of the things that are occurring to you, that happened to you, were you the result of what other people did. And it's legitimate that you are a victim. And there's at a certain point, God can speak to us and help us to move on towards him in this. And that's really powerless when something was done to you.
Mm-hmm.
But you can, with the help of therapists and programs, and of course the Holy Spirit and Jesus, move forward and get into a community where you can get some healing and wholeness. And that's always good news.
All right, we'll take a little break. When we come back, our special guest, Rosie, will tell her story. We'll be right back. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George.
Try to see things my way. Do I have to keep on?
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
All right, we are back to Real Recovery. Bill and George got a great program tonight. Rosie's going to come on the show and talk about growing up with alcoholism in the family. And George, I know that there is this acceptance step where, you know, you realize, because you were talking about step one before the break and how we're powerless even as younger children to save our family. And we have to figure out a way to kind of stop punishing ourselves and others for sometimes not being enough. I can't make it stop in my family. And you start to realize you can't save your family. You're just a kid.
Yes. You said a key word there. The step is admitted. And one of my gurus, the late, great Bob Johnson, always used to say, if I could change one word in the 12 steps, it would be from admitted to accepted.
Mm.
Because you got to do something about it when you accept it.
Mm-hmm. So tonight we're going to hear a story of what it's like to have grown up in an alcoholic family. And I think there's going to be a lot of people tonight listening who will identify with that. Maybe it was your own family or a relative, and you understood to some degree what was going on. So Rosie is our guest. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bill.
So I'm always curious, because I think when you grow up with alcoholism in the family, you start to grow up fast because you have to take on adult responsibilities. Mm-hmm. Was that the case with you?
You know, it was, but there are a lot of other variables at play, too. I was 7 out of 10 kids, so just the dynamics of having a family of 10 children makes, yeah. You know, you have responsibilities and jobs and take care of your siblings. And so there was already a fabric of being over responsible.
Okay.
And there was also a fabric, you know, there was also the opportunity that you could get away with some things because your siblings were taking care of you and you could pin it on them. But so I think what's complicated about growing up as a child in an addictive home is that the variables can interweave with those steps that you were talking about mm-hmm. earlier. And so where did, you know, the over-responsibility, did that come because I was in an addictive home, or did that come because of the dysfunction of being one of 10 kids? Lovely dysfunction, but yeah. still dysfunction, right? And so it's kind of hard to separate.
I bet.
Yeah. And for me, in our case, I am the seventh of 10 children. And when we noticed that my mom had an addictive issue with alcohol, I think I was 14. And so all the chaos of growing up with kids running all over, I mean, we grew up Irish Catholic, and there were, I think, three other families that had more than eight children on our block. So, you know, this is what we would hear, come in when the lights, you know, when the street lights are on, come home kind of thing. So it was so hard to figure out where addiction actually happened. We recognized it when I was 14, for sure. I remember that. And we had moved from Illinois to Minnesota and away from our support network. I grew up in a very small town. And so when the drinking from my mom became very chronic, we were moving to Minnesota with no network. And so that was very, very difficult. And I think the responsibility of, you know, when you were going through that list, I was thinking of each of my siblings that are older than I am. And I thought, oh my gosh, my life is, the product of my life is because my siblings stepped in and helped. I had a sister who would come and give up her summers and take care of us kids and come up. I had another sister who actually moved from Chicago to Minnesota to take care of us, the, you know, the remaining five that were at home. My two older brothers were at home too still. And so I just think of that over-responsibility without that network of love. I don't know where I would be today. And so even in the difficulty of having those characteristics, there is an Achilles heel that's quite beautiful. You know, the love that comes out to care and to take care of those that are also in pain with you is beautiful. It can be toxic, but in its core, it's something that's I cherish in each of my siblings.
Wow, that's beautiful. Beautiful opening statement, giving us a picture of your big family.
Yeah, I remember. So my mom, I think I don't know. We've talked about this on shows with you, Bill, before, but my mom was in treatment 21 times. And so there was a lot of opportunity for family growth in that. And I remember it was like the second or third treatment center somewhere in the 80s. And treatment centers were just evolving at that time. I mean, there was a couple, but they were learning their way. And so there was some mistakes made in those early years. I don't think they probably do that anymore. But I remember my oldest sister, Terry, sitting down with all of us and saying, this is bad. And we are, as a family, have to choose what we're going to do with it. Is it going to pull us apart, or are we going to stay together? And so as a fabric in our family, we've chosen to stay together through ups and downs of a lot of different things with my mom. But it was also grounded in that, in our faith as a family. My dad was a deacon. Well, actually, he's retired, so still a deacon of the Catholic Church. And God was very present theologically in conversation, in prayer. My mom loved the Lord and would express that in acts of service for others. But God was continuously woven into our relationships, even as we demonstrated a lot of those behavior patterns mm-hmm. that I was sitting there going, oh, yeah, that was me. That was me when I was 22. And then I got counseling. I got rid of that one. And, you know, Gary said, it's just, it weaves back and forth. You always have to stay on top of some of these characteristic traits for sure.
Mm-hmm. And I think you meant George or Gary?
Oh, George. I'm sorry. No, yeah, Gary's okay. My husband.
Gary,
sorry.
Gary's your husband.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah, sorry, George.
I thought maybe Gary said something wise because George says wise things every
Thank
once in a
you.
While.
Oh, George, you're going to have to give me forgiveness for that.
I've been called a lot worse, so it's just fine. Yeah, it's very interesting to hear you talk, and you say it so well. And the part about the love, it's interesting to me, Bill, to hear that's a person's memory of this. And my guess is the story gets pretty hard as we go forward. Mm-hmm. But to focus on that's a real credit to you.
Oh, well, thank you. It's I wish I could take credit for that, George. I think that's the beauty of walking this life with the Lord. And it's if you were to ask me one thing that breaks my heart for people and families that are in addiction. It's the fact that the addiction, the enemy, whatever you want to call it, has stolen their identity of how much God loves them. And the shame and the guilt and the I wish and the broken dreams and bitter expectations, those can take front seat, and they shouldn't, because the love of God, you know, he doesn't promise us a perfect life. He promises a life that he'll be with us. And so through those hard times, to be able to call a sibling, to be able to call somebody, and we didn't as a family live in secret with it because we had this big network. You know, I might not have told my friends and my school friends, but I could call my sister, I could call my brother. This is what's happening in the home. And, you know, there it was a net, and we're very blessed to have that net for sure. Mm.
That often is not the story, Rosie.
It's not.
It's such a rare story, I think, we're hearing tonight, that there's this cohesive, we're in this together, we love, we're supporting.
Mm-hmm.
And 21 treatments is a lot of disappointments and failures for the kids, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's, and without exaggeration, some of those disappointments were harder to get over than others.
Oh,
and so, but that's the journey of it, is holding each other in when the disappointments are very difficult, and being honest with those disappointments. And the truth is you're living life. You know, I was 14. I think my youngest brother might have been in second grade at the time of when my mom's addictions really started.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, there's stuffing of feelings. There is, you know, you have to go to school. You can't talk to your teacher that your mom is on the couch,
mm-hmm.
right? And at the same time, my mom also had a very productive life under it. You know, so there was a yo-yo effect of being going back and forth. Is she okay this week? Is she really bad the next week? And so that inconsistency produces a lot of behavior that takes counseling and it takes the Lord to unwind, honestly.
Did you find that you were walking on eggshells often around the house because we didn't know what kind of condition she would be in? And
yeah, eggshells, yes. You know,
were you trying to prevent her from drinking and relapsing and fighting that battle?
Absolutely, Bill. Thank you for bringing that up. So my mom had an addiction style that was secretive. So she would hide the alcohol in vases and all these things. And for, I think, from 14 to probably 19, 20 for me, I was still in that. But Mom, we found it, because it took her a while to admit that she was an alcoholic. And so that sickness of trying to find it and prove to her that she was is really, really damaging. And it took a long time and a lot of counseling. And that's what I would encourage anybody who's gone through addiction with a parent, a husband, a child, whatever it may be, that the counseling to really address what you are trying to do to help that person get safe, you know, to help that person stop drinking. Because I think, George, you said it, you know, so beautifully in the beginning of the show, is that you really can't. You can't help them.
Right.
But you can walk with them in love.
All right, we're going to take a little break. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. Our special guest, Rosie, is here. She is an adult child of an alcoholic. So many are out there in that very same situation. We'll be right back.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery. I remember when I lost my mind.
There was something so pleasant about that place. Welcome back to Real Recovery, Bill and George. So glad to have Rosie with us tonight. She is talking about what it's like growing up with an alcoholic parent. I know this is going to resonate with a lot of listeners tonight because you were in that same situation. Rosie, your story is quite unusual. I just have to go back to the fact that you are sort of connected with your siblings, and there's not this division amongst siblings because of mom's struggle.
No, it was actually something that, for such a large family and all these different personalities, you know, I feel like there was a silver lining. Genesis 50:20 says, "What the enemy intended for evil, I plan to make unto good for the betterment of other lives." And I think that how God worked in our situation is it made us as siblings closer. Now, that doesn't mean it was perfect and, you know, we didn't have different opinions on how things should be handled, or, you know, just not able to bear each other's sufferings. Like, I know my older siblings that were launched and in their careers, mm-hmm. and the younger five of us were still at home. You know, it broke their heart, and they did what they could in their early 20s to come and give us relief. And that is very different. That's an extremely different example than what many, many people have. And it's why I hold so dearly to love being an important part of any relationship with any person who's in addiction, whether they are addicted themselves or whether you're supporting the spouse or the kids or you're an aunt or you're an uncle. Being loving for those that are, you know, at that first level of interaction with the addict is essential to helping them stay in the game and to helping them not have those wounds of victimhood and all these other things. Because the love of God is the hope that things that he is always being restorative and that he is the redeemer of lost time. And so as my mom went through all those treatment centers, there was varying. It felt like a hilly terrain. You know, I remember when I held my son, Bennett, for the first time, and it was the first time, and I think I was 32, maybe something like that. I held him, and it was the first time I understood the power of addiction, because I had always thought in my head, even with a lot of counseling, man, if you know, the love of her kids should be able to break that desire for the drink, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until I held Bennett that I went, oh my gosh, my mom loves us like this 10 times over. And the drink is that powerful. And I think that was the beginning of my ability to forgive and to understand from a different position that this woman is battling. She is trying her hardest to get out of this. And for her, it was a lifetime battle from there on.
When she would have an attempt at recovery, and mm-hmm. then she would have a period of sobriety, mm-hmm. and then she would relapse, what was the tone in the household like?
Oh.
Was it, here we go again?
Yeah.
Did you feel like she made progress and she was not starting back at zero? Or do you feel like we made some progress, we're going to try to do it again?
Right.
What was the tone?
All of the above.
Okay.
And I think if you ask any 10 of us, we would have different responses. I remember a couple siblings, you know, at our, I don't know, sixth family or seventh family intervention, this isn't working, I'm not attending anymore, right?
Oh, wow.
And so I don't think, I couldn't even put my own emotions on a linear line and say this is how I felt each time, because they weren't consistent. Because sometimes she had this sweet period of sobriety. My parents were divorced, you know, it was that philosophy that you have to help someone hit rock bottom. So my dad did something completely against who he is as a man of God to help her, and they divorced. And it was the hardest thing I think he's ever done. And it did buy a couple years of sobriety. They remarried 7 years later or something. We call it their little spat. But because they lived in the same apartment complex,
mm-hmm.
you know, there was a parking lot between them. It was kind of hysterical. It's like no divorce that is ever written down in any book. But he was doing that to help her have sobriety.
Mm-hmm.
And she did for a little while. But again, to what George said, is that you can love somebody, but it's between them and God on when that break comes. And to love them into that place is a privilege, and it's difficult, and it's the hardest thing I think any of the 10 of us had to ever do, is to love her through the addiction.
I'm amazed when somebody goes to treatment over 20 times. What mm-hmm. we used to say in recovery was that if you don't get sober, you don't want it bad enough.
Yeah.
If you go to 20 some treatments, you want it bad enough.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a mystery to me how anybody gets sober, because none of us want to.
Mm-hmm.
It's not plan A. And yet, when somebody does that, I don't know why they don't get sober. And I've got, Bill, we have a couple friends like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're great people, God-fearing people. Mm-hmm. They're just not sober.
I remember, George, one of the times nursing my mom through an episode or two, and I don't remember how old I was necessarily, but I remember she was in my lap, and that's just, you know, what addiction would do is that she would just, you know, turn into a very different person, because my mom, when she was not drinking, was fierce. But she was in this very broken position. She was in my lap, and I just remember touching her forehead to forehead, because she was a good mom. She taught us well. And I remember forehead to forehead saying, "Mom, if you could just practice what you preached, you know, if you could just know how beautiful you are, how much you're loved, that you are forgiven, you're forgiven by God, you're forgiven by us, if you could hold on to that." And I think she really wanted to, George. I just think it was, she just had a really hard time to forgive herself. And I think that's what kind of would lead back into the drink, is that she would get points of sobriety, and then she would think about everything she had done through the alcohol or what she couldn't remember, and she would see the pain and suffering, and then it would just drive her right back to, "You're worthless, no one loves you, no one can forgive you," that kind of thing. And so it's literally what breaks my heart today. I think that's why when I hear somebody diminish who they are, it breaks my heart, because we are all loved by God, and who we are in God is beautiful. But yet receiving that for ourselves and knowing it and standing there when the enemy wants to tell you how awful you are, how guilt-ridden you should be, when he wants to attack shame to you, God would never say any of those things. And I think as a Christian body, we have a hard time figuring out those two voices and being able to identify. Even Jesus, when he was listening to Peter, he said, "Satan, get behind me," right? Like, so even Satan was trying to tell Jesus things that Jesus shouldn't receive. And so it's the one thing that I wish my mom could have received, the amount of love that was coming towards her. I think it was very difficult for her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think those fiery darts from the enemy, we just have to turn over to God. I think some days I get up and I say my prayers for, you know, get out of bed, because kind of needy about sobriety and all that. Mm-hmm. But it's like there's a buzzard or something on my bedpost. It's like, "Okay, guys, he's up. What's his game? What's thoughts?" And, you know, alcoholism is in the DSM-5. It's a mental illness, according to the DSM-5. I don't know. I'm not a doctor, but we think differently. Mm-hmm. Okay. And over and over through the years, I've heard people that I work with and myself, we have a couple sins, Rosie, that we know aren't forgiven. God forgave us, but we don't forgive ourselves, which is idolatry. I have higher standards than God does. We had a guest on our show, Bill, I don't know if you remember this, Dennis Otto, who said he was working with a guy, and he said, "You know what? Where in the Bible does it say you're supposed to forgive your own sins? It doesn't. That's Jesus's job. Mm-hmm. Quit being God." And that really helped me, because I find myself doing that, you know, and I think your mom, I'm sure that was a big part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not for us to do.
No, it's really not. And that's the transfer of overing, giving it to Christ and believing that he has it. Right. So someone told me somewhere in my lines of counseling, I'm trying to think of what year it was, maybe in my 30s somewhere, that Jesus owns our past, that he took our past, he owns it. We shouldn't go back there unless we're walking hand in hand with him and he wants to put some healing someplace. He's got our future, and that's his to direct and design, and he wants us today with him in the present. And that has helped me so many times, instead of going back into should have beens, could have beens, would have beens, it's easier to leave that on the cross when I know he owns it and that he's with me today. That's a very different position, because I think sometimes that family behavior of victimhood and all that can repeat itself when we give the past too much credit.
I love that. That's really well
said. That's a really powerful image, that God will take you by the hand if you go into your past, but it's for healing purposes and he'll go with you.
Mm-hmm.
That's really strong.
Yeah, it was a great, I remember when the counselor told me that and I went, "Oh, I'm not supposed to be opening that door without him then."
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I better leave that door. Yeah.
All right. We'll take a little break. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. We're so glad you're listening tonight. And we're so glad to have Rosie as our guest tonight. If you grew up in a household that had an alcoholic parent, you're going to love this episode. If you missed any of it, you can always go to the Real Recovery show page and the podcast will be available. Maybe there is someone you know you can send it on. who also needs to hear this interview. We'll take a short break and be right back.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
We're back, we're back, we're back. This is a Real Recovery. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Bill Arnold and George P. Fraser. George, quite a story tonight, as always.
It's great.
Yep.
Great stuff.
We get the best guests ever. That's all I'm going to say.
I'm going to agree. Can I agree?
You can agree if you want.
All right. Yeah, I'm just going to give myself a pat on the back.
Yeah. Might as well.
Right.
Yeah. Rosie's our guest, and she grew up with a alcoholic mother, and there was obviously, after 21 treatments, a lot of difficulty and challenges and disappointments, yet the love in that family was strong and cohesive, and that's one of the biggest takeaways for me tonight, Rosie, is that there was, you're almost a big exception to the rule. Usually it divides families, and they have a hard time loving.
I agree.
Yeah.
And we all had a hard time loving going back and forth. But there was that commitment to each other early on. And, you guys, it's not just a commitment by words. It's my siblings showed it. You know, my sister moving up, my other sister coming in and staying over summers. Just all these different actions, their love was expressed. And that kept us connected and with hope. Yep.
So, Rosie, as you, I know your story to the degree that your mother's not with us anymore.
Mm-mm.
And I'm so sorry about that.
Thank you.
But I would love to hear the conversations and those last years together.
Yeah. So my mom and I had a sweet relationship all through our life. It was very private and unique, and I cherish it today. She made my wedding dress. We wrote poems back and forth to each other. It was very tender and very unique to us, which I just think is a tribute to how she was able to love 10 people separately, even addicted. She was an amazing mom.
That's amazing.
And I'm sure all my other siblings have private little things that they did with her as well. So at the end of her life, she passed actually from lung cancer. She smoked quite a bit since she was 14. And so it went very quickly once it was found. And I think she had 6 weeks from diagnosis to departure into heaven. In the last 10 days, my sisters and I there's five girls and five boys. My sisters and I would be at her bedside in twos, and we just walk her through. And she wanted to pass at home, and so we were her hospice care actually. But I was waiting for by one of our shifts, and I was with my mom by myself, and she wasn't taking pain meds. She was drinking until the last 2 days, but she wasn't doing oxygen, and there was a lot of things that she was saying no to, and she was feeling and looking peaceful. But for whatever reason, it was towards the end, and I was there by myself waiting for my sister to come, and I just sat with her and got her up, sitting up, and I said, "Mom, how are you doing? It's getting close. How are you feel about going to heaven?" And she said, and she had these steel green eyes that like Scarlett O'Hara would have loved, right? Like my mom, you did not cross my mom, Bill. Like when she would, when she would get her, "I'm the mother of 10 kids and I don't care how much taller you are than me," or whatever. You didn't cross her. And she was sitting there and she looked at me with those steel green eyes and she said, "Well, I guess it's fine because I'm going to purgatory. And at least someone else will get out because I'm coming in." And I looked at her, and we were raised Catholic. I don't know that we ever talked about purgatory, and I don't practice Catholicism, so I was quite surprised that she said that. And I said, "Mom, why would you think that?" And, okay, so humor in a family of 10 can be sophomoric, and we laugh at everything. And so she did that that drinking thing with your thumb and your finger, and she made this motion like,
the drinking motion.
The drinking motion. Yeah. Like, I've had a couple, Rosie. You know that.
Okay.
And that was
sending her to purgatory.
And that was sending her to purgatory.
Okay.
And so I sat with her for a second, and I prayed quickly, and I felt like I heard the Lord audibly. And because I'm asking, "Lord, does she need a salvation prayer? Like, what do I do with this?" And I felt him speak into my heart, "Don't be legalistic. She's afraid." And so prior to her getting sick, I had been reading a lot of books about, you know, journeys to heaven and coming back. I don't know why they came except for this purpose. And so I started telling her stories about heaven that people had gone and seen and come back, and the peace and the joy. And I started telling her things from the Bible about what Jesus says, that he's going to be the one that takes us home, that he won't send anybody else, but he'll be there. And as I was telling her these stories, Bill, she stared me down. And it was a stare I knew I wasn't going to break. Now, you never stared my mom down, just so you know. But it was a stare I knew I wasn't going to break, because I knew that she needed to be confident in something. And we looked at each other. It felt like 3 hours, but it was probably 20 seconds. And she said, "And that's what you believe." And we stared at each other for about another 20 seconds. And I said, "Yep, because it's the truth. It doesn't matter what I believe. It's the truth. It's the biblical truth." And she stared me down yet again, and I didn't break her stare. I don't even think I blinked. And she said, "Okay, then." And her whole countenance changed, that angry, that upright, that feeling of I'm not enough was gone in an instant. And her face softened, her body kind of softened, and she said, "Okay, then, get me in bed, and I'll take that oxygen now." And I started laughing with her, and I said, "Okay, then?" And she goes, "Yep, okay." And I got her in bed, and I started laughing with her because I'm not the nurse in the family. There's two nurses, and this oxygen's been sitting there, and I didn't know how to, like, turn it on for her. So here she is, an LPN herself, telling me how to give her oxygen. And we're laughing. We have this sweet little time, and my sister came in. My mom said maybe a couple more things, and then she went into a coma, and that was it. So it was this beautiful opportunity to walk her home. Mm-hmm. And I'm tearing up, and I didn't think I was going to.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And what a tender recognition of her need for a Savior and her acceptance of that Savior.
Absolutely. And I think it kind of goes back to what we were talking before. She loved the Lord, and it was accepting his forgiveness and accepting, you know, wherever that fit for her. No one ever knows how someone feels, but I think it was that she was loved despite, you know, her last 40-some years of addiction, that she was loved in spite of that, and that Jesus would still be there to take her home. Like, she had to walk into that, and she had to receive that for herself. And I saw it. I saw it visually with my eyes, and it was the most beautiful thing I could have ever witnessed, I think.
That is so, so great. I think there's a real thin line between if you think you deserve salvation, you need to look at that. We do accept it, but it's not deserved. It's a gift.
Right.
And when I work with people and they go, "Well, that's too good to be true," I think they're on the right track, because it is. Mm-hmm. That's why we call it a miracle. Mm-hmm.
It's so true. And I just want to say there's a lot of people that would get caught up in the Catholic Protestantness of all that, and that wasn't the point at all. It wasn't about... George, it's everything what you just said. It has nothing to do with her thought that she was going to purgatory or the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church is beautiful in a lot of wonderful ways. It was more about her receiving and the love of Christ, regardless of any action she had done or hadn't done in her life.
Yeah, absolutely. I for one, have a lot of Catholic friends. They seem to be a lot more normal than other friends. But when I go to Mass, which I don't all the time, but the reverence for God, Christ has died, Christ has risen, Christ will come again, gives me goosebumps.
Mm-hmm.
And same Jesus both places. So
mm-hmm. I agree.
George, you go to Mass about once every 5 years.
I should go to confession week. Yeah.
It's okay, George. I've been confessing for you. Psalm 51.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Gosh, that was such a sweet story.
Yeah, it was. It was such a blessing. I feel like there's another sweet story to it about, and I want to share these stories not because I know my family was unique in their journey, but I want to share these stories as inspiration of hope and forgiveness if you are walking with an alcoholic, or you are one yourself. The room for forgiveness and restoration and redemption through the blood of Christ is limitless. So when my mom was in that coma, my brothers couldn't be there because she just wanted her, she wanted to be with her girls. And they're just, it was just such a small apartment. So we got all of our brothers on the phone and put the phone on speaker, and we all said the Our Father over her. And so we were all there. And we had all experienced her addiction in different ways, and yet every single one of us were there to pray her home. And it was a beautiful closure to a woman who fought so hard and is free now in heaven.
It's beautiful, Rosie. I know you're going to be touching a lot of hearts tonight. I mean, any mom story takes me to the cleaners. So.
I know.
It's so beautiful.
Well, there was just so many times in my years of not feeling, of wanting the success of the redemption to be her sobriety, and I think we all want that, and that's a beautiful thing that, you know, would have been lovely, but I think very much the fruit out of this whole journey was a mom and children who loved her, and a husband. I mean, I haven't talked a lot about my dad, but he was right there the whole time. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think sometimes we look for certain fruit, and the fruit is our idea of what God would want, and heaven's economy says maybe something else. And in this case, I think the fruit was a family that was still loving her.
Mm-hmm.
Amen. Hey, Rosie, mm-hmm. I can lose my sobriety, but I can't lose my salvation.
Right, right. Isn't that beautiful?
I take great comfort in that because I'm amazed I'm still sober, okay? It's a God thing.
Yeah.
And I think there's confusion with people that you get sober, you're saved. It just in the other side of the coin, you get saved, you're going to guarantee sobriety. Two different issues.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So, Rosie, I know we have touched a nerve with tons of listeners tonight because they are in a situation where they went through what you went through.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that they're encouraged by the story of love. Because if they're still in that family system, that's a step they can take tonight to try to heal some of that pain and some of that disappointment. And
right.
How would you encourage people to start connecting with love again?
Well, for me, it was so subtle. I didn't even know Jesus was doing it. But as I opened my heart to a relationship with Christ that was different than just in my head, but it had moved to my heart, He helped me go into those painful places and to lay them down. I mean, the truth is we have expectations of, you know, how our life should be and how people in our life should love us and all these different things. And those expectations can get so difficult, and you can mourn them and you can feel like you were cheated because it wasn't the way it was supposed to be, the Brady Bunch life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I know for me, it was as I trusted the Lord, I asked him into those places. Can you walk with me, Lord, when this happened? Can you be there with me? Can you teach me can you give me what I didn't receive? And can you teach me why I didn't receive it? And so it's that vulnerability to open yourself up into some past memories that really, really hurt, but to let them also lay at the cross, because God has them now. And yeah. That's where his restoration happens, and that's where he redeems the lost time.
I love that. Jesus owns your past.
He does own your past. And don't go in there without holding his hands.
Don't go there without
him.
No, yeah.
Don't open up a memory unless you're willing to ask God, how can you heal this in me?
Yeah.
And Rosie, what can you do with it?
Rosie, thank you so much for being our guest tonight. It's been wonderful hearing your story.
Thank you. I loved being on the show.
Incredible encouragement. George, as you know, that wraps up yet another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. Any parting thoughts?
Rosie, that was fabulous. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much for listening to Real Recovery tonight. Glad that you could join us. We will do this again next week. Have a great week, everyone. Good night, and God bless. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.